that was a good audio, but let's try again. So the title of my talk, my sermon, bad feedback.
Maybe I'll go lower my t-shirt.
Now, take two. So the title of my talk today is Structural Results of Sensor Activation and Dynamic Spectrum Access. The main idea is how can we use some very clever results in game theory and stochastic control to come up with useful results when you have lots of sensors or lots of radios communicating over a network. I think that's what we're going to talk about. I apologize for the echo. That's better now? Okay. Okay, some dynamic adjustment. Okay, so in terms of a picture, there are really two pictures you need to, I guess, keep in mind. Okay, should have an adaptive tuner or something here, or move it up and down. Okay, so there are two pictures which you might want to keep in mind throughout this talk. The first is the idea where you have little sensors who each sensor has constrained battery life, and there's a fundamental trade-off between the cost of sensing, which consumes energy, and the utility of the information gathered, which presumably is something like a mean square error. That's one type of thing to keep in mind. And then suppose sensors don't want to communicate too much amongst each other due to power constraints and so on. How can you cleverly track some important event, like a target moving through a sensor field, for the sensors to automatically switch on and off with minimal communication amongst them? Okay, that's one thing we're going to talk about today. An equivalent idea, at least mathematically, is to consider the problem where you have lots of radios. These are called cognitive radios, and I'll talk a little bit about it. It's a hot area at the moment, where these radios jump into sparsely used spectrum regions and communicate. Okay, and I'm going to talk about both in a minute. So both ideas involve this concept of decentralized control, and we're going to actually formulate some of this in a game theoretic setting as well. So in terms of dynamic spectrum access, in terms of a picture again, it's kind of known from empirical measurements that a lot of the spectrum is underutilized. Okay, so these are typical figures people give in papers, and I've just kind of plagiarized a couple of papers. Something like 62% of the white space of the spectrum under 3 gigahertz is unused, 75% idle time in FTP sessions, 90% idle time in Skype, and so on. So the idea in opportunistic spectrum access is that secondary users who are not licensed to use a particular spectral band can jump in when the primary user is not active, do their business, and then jump out when the primary user comes back. Okay. Of course, the point being that often the secondary users have to act decentralized because there may or may not be a base station which controls the different secondary users. So how can they share the resources efficiently in a decentralized manner and yet also exploit information about the nature of the primary user, because they're not allowed to interfere with the primary user? When the primary user comes in, they got to get out of the system. Well, in some cases, they're called spectrum overlay. In spectrum underlay, they can communicate as long as the noise floor, as long as the interference they generate does not adversely affect the primary user. So in any case, the idea being that you want to really back off when there's a primary user and you want to self-regulate yourself. So this sort of dynamic spectrum access is one factor which is fairly important in this area called cognitive radio, where people suggest a lot of other stuff in cognitive radio as well. Cognitive radio is supposed to be context-aware, autonomous, reconfigurable, and all that sort of stuff. Dynamic spectrum access is one important part of cognitive radio. There's certainly a lot of recent work in the area of cognitive radio and dynamic spectrum access, as witnessed by lots of papers and special issues and so on. Okay, so the outline of my talk is really in three parts. In part one, I want to talk about a fairly new approach to dealing with decentralized sensor activation, or how different cognitive radios can dynamically switch between different spectral gaps without adversely affecting one another and without affecting a primary user. The technique we're going to use is something called global gains, which has been widely used in economic systems. I just want to talk about that quite a lot. There are several nice properties about it. First, a Nash equilibrium exists. I'm not going to prove that here because that's typically a fixed point theorem and it's going to put everybody to sleep in the afternoon. So the fixed point theorem and the proof of the existence of a Nash equilibrium is not difficult to show, but I'm not going to talk about it. More importantly, from a practical perspective, it has a very nice structure. Meaning that each sensor simply measures a particular quantity, and if that quantity is greater than a threshold, then it broadcasts. Or each cognitive radio measures a particular characteristic of the spectrum, and if it's greater than a particular value, it transmits. Very simple. A single number parameterizes the whole thing. And also, intellectual curiosity, funny stuff happens. Meaning that there could be a sudden phase transition in the behavior of the Nash as the noise distribution changes, which is really pretty weird, and I'll describe that very briefly as well. So that'll be the first part of the talk. We're really talking about these global gains. The second part of the talk is sort of in a slightly different vein, where rather than a global games approach, we talk about, given that you have several sensors or cognitive radio systems, how can they learn a useful behavior so as to communicate with the end user? Okay. The idea there is we're going to talk about this concept of a correlated equilibrium, which is actually in many ways much nicer than a Nash equilibrium to characterize. Secondly, the analysis of such an algorithm is actually pretty cute. The weak convergence analysis leads to something which is completely non-standard, and I'm going to talk about that a bit. The third part of the talk will be on how you can formulate this as a centralized. And the idea there is it's a partially observed stochastic control problem, so these are notoriously dirty, but again, you can come up with conditions for which the optimal policy has a very nice structure. So really interested in structural results under certain assumptions. That is roughly the three parts of the talk, and I'm going to start off with part one on global games. The simplest way of thinking of a global game is the following thought experiment. So you have L nightclubs in a city, okay, and there are a lot of patrons, actually a continuum of patrons, a very large number of patrons, and you can choose either to go to one of the nightclubs or stay at home, okay? The basis of your choice is based on the quality of music you hear from the nightclub. So X is a vector here comprising of the different qualities of music from the L different nightclubs observed in noise. Okay, so you have a noisy measurement of the music. And your aim is to decide, based on this quality of music, you want to optimize a utility in your own sense. Well, that utility function, of course, depends on the quality of music. So the higher the quality of music, the better off the nightclub is. Plus, another term which penalizes if too many other people go to the nightclub because it's too crowded, and also penalizes if too few people go to the nightclub because there's not enough social interaction. So this guy F is quasi-concave. Something goes up and down, typically. Okay. Now, you assume that everybody is rational and they know that you know this information, and you know that they know that you know this information, and so on, ad infinitum. That's like a game. What is your optimal choice of which nightclub do you go to? Do you stay at home or do you go to one of the L nightclubs? Okay. This is a formalism of a global game. The reason it's called a global game is because you're playing against the entire system. Alpha here is the proportion of guys which go to the different nightclubs. Okay, so your cost function depends, if you choose nightclub U, your cost depends on alpha U, the percentage of people which go to the nightclub, the proportion of people, of course, plus the quality of music, but this is going up and down. It's a quasi-concave function. It doesn't have to be quasi-concave. If this was monotonely increasing, the solution is trivial, or if it's monotonely decreasing. So it's only kind of interesting when it's going up and down. Okay. Okay, so this problem, of course, has several analogs. In sensor networks, the obvious analog is that you're measuring some quality of information in each sensor, and the utility each sensor measures is the quality of information plus some function of how many other sensors are on. If too few sensors are on, then by averaging the measurements of all those sensors, you don't reduce the noise enough because you need more information. If too many sensors are on, you have congestion in your transmission or wastage of battery, so it goes up and down. That's an obvious example. Another example would be, if this would be spectral gaps, so you have in a cognitive radio system, you have one of L spectral holes at the moment. If too many people jump into a particular spectrum hole thinking that the quality of music or the quality of the channels are very good, then it's going to be congested. If too few people jump, then the resources are not utilized sufficiently. So obviously this makes sense in from an abstract point of view. I've kind of skipped a lot of the mathematical sophistication behind this. This is, and it can be shown this is a well-formulated problem and so on. The alpha is defined, as I said, for a continuum of sensors. So you can think of it as n goes to infinity and nl is the fraction of people which go to nightclub L or speckle cap L or whatever. Okay, so that's alpha of L. Now, of course, there's a lot of work on how you derive a good utility function. That's a million-dollar issue. Yes?
Is there some circularity in this algorithm? Because you're choosing a maximum of this quantity, but that quantity depends on alpha, which is only derived from the actual choice you make.
No, alpha is a percentage of everybody else who goes down. Given that you're a single individual and there is an infinite number of people, it doesn't really matter, your particular choice. It does, and we're going to talk about that. How we optimize the policy is a major issue here.
But this is the policy.
No, this is a cost function. Your policy is some function which maps your measurement to your choice U. That's which nightclub you go to. Okay, we'll come to that in a second. So, the derivation of the utility itself, there are lots of choices, and I'm not going to go into the details here. People have different things like quality of service and so on. I just thought I'd mention a very simple example here. So, for example, this could be the sum of all the usages of the different spectrum holds, because remember, XL was a quality, alpha L was a percentage of people in there. So this could be like the usage, and this could be something like the quality, because P to the N alpha L is the probability of a vacant transmission if you're using some sort of CSMA protocol. If everybody transmits with probability P, then the probability of successfully transmitting is 1 minus P to the NA. Okay, so if this is your global utility, you could think of your local utility as the incremental benefit you derive by taking the derivative respect to alpha. Okay, so this could be your local utility. It's just one interpretation, it's not important, but it could be just one way of thinking about it. So the problem is, if each user is assumed to be rational, which NYSA spectral cap should they choose? Okay. There's a lot of work, as I said, being done in this area in global games. In economics, it's used in speculative currency attacks. It really turns out to be a very useful tool for decentralized coordination. That's why it's kind of useful here. The nightclub analogy, as I mentioned, came out in a paper in 2007 by Karp, Lee, and Mason. They deal with a univariate uniform noise case, and what they're generalizing here is to multivariate and arbitrary different noise distributions, so that's why it's of interest. There are several obvious generalizations. The first possible generalization is you have several classes of patrons who choose a single nightclub, okay? So you have one nightclub and you have several classes of people. So maybe somebody is listening to the quality of the guitarist, somebody else is listening to the quality of the pianist, and they have interaction coefficients in terms of their cost. How do they decide where to go? A more substantial generalization is you have multiple nightclubs, okay? And how do you decide which nightclub to go? As I mentioned, if F of alpha is monotone in alpha, then this result has been known since around 2000, that you have a very simple threshold policy for your Nash, and that's well known. Excuse me, is your hand up or you were stretching? Well, because you could have L spectral gaps, not just one spectral gap. So you have several possible spectral gaps at a given time point. You as a radio can decide which one of these spectral gaps you jump to. Or you could have L different targets which you're trying to measure, and you can measure only one of those. I'm sorry. It possibly could be, yeah. I mean, this is a standard example which was taken from the paper by Cartley and Mason. It could well be, but this was just the example just taken from a paper, so. Okay, it's possible. I guess it could be, but this was the example which is kind of standard in the area. There's also a really good book on rational herds by Chamley in 2004, which does some work on this. Okay, let me give you a simplified version of the problem, and then we'll talk about how you can actually do this. Yeah, we're assuming in this case that you have a measurement vector, which is a vector of all the qualities of the channels in noise. Yeah, so you have a measurement vector at this stage. Yeah. In part two of the talk, we'll talk about different types of other formulations. This is a more specific formulation, but it has a nicer structure. I guess the more assumptions you make, the better the structure of your final solution. That's typically the way it goes, right? So let's first consider the special case where you have two possibilities. You either stay at home or you go to a nightclub, or you stay at your current spectral hole or you jump to another spectral cap. Okay, that's like a simple version of this problem. And in this special case, you could, I guess without loss of generality, assume that your utility, if you pick action one, is zero, because you can always subtract it from utility two. It's only a difference which makes it. And H2 of X alpha is CX plus F alpha. okay? And your policy is mu of your measurement y, which maps to your action u, okay? Now the question is, what is your optimal policy? Which nightclub do you pick, right? And the answer is that your policy mu is a Nash equilibrium if it maximizes E of HU, X alpha. It simply means the following, that if every user came up with a solution that maximizes this, and one person unilaterally deviated, they would be worse off. That's, I guess, the standard definition of a Nash, okay? Now, there's a very clean structure behind this Nash equilibrium, which I wish to discuss now. In general, the Nash equilibrium could be randomized, okay? There's no reason why it should be a pure policy. It could be a randomized function of mu, of y, of your measurement. The point here, it turns out, is that your Nash is pure, which is kind of nice, which has been shown, actually, by the paper by Karp and so on in 2007. What is even nicer, it has a very nice structure that it's equal, that you pick to go, the action to go, if your reward is greater than zero, otherwise you stay. Okay? So you decide to go only if your expectation of H2 of X alpha is greater than zero, otherwise you stay. I'm going to qualify this in a minute in terms of picture, so I'll come to it maybe right now. So here's what I mean. So here is your conditional expectation of your reward, H of X alpha, given your measurement. Okay, so this x-axis is y. This is your conditional expectation of reward. If this guy crosses only once, if this function has a single crossing, then your optimal policy then becomes a simple threshold. For regions where this is less than zero, you obviously don't go. For regions where it's greater than zero, you go. Okay, so the entire problem boils down to showing that a particular conditional expectation of your utility, given your measurement, has a single crossing. Okay, a sufficient condition, of course, is that it's monotone in y. Okay, because if a function is monotone in y, then if it does intersect, it's only going to intersect once. Okay, so a sufficient condition is monotone in y. So this theory, at least for the uniform case, is kind of been known since the paper of Karp, which was in 2007. And furthermore, you can show that your Nash equilibrium is the point at which this crosses zero. Okay, so the value of y star, where E of H of X alpha given y star equals zero, is the value of your Nash equilibrium. Okay, so you can show this as well. So at least now we have a fairly simple characterization of the Nash. If you can show that a conditional expectation is monotone, then it's pretty nice, or at least if it intersects once, I think in a second. And the value which intersects is the Nash equilibrium. Yes? This is a Nash equilibrium for the entire system. So in the sense that if any user deviates from this, they're worse off. Locally from this policy. Yeah, the policy mu is what which maps your action, your y to your action, whether you go or don't go.
So in the Nash equilibrium, some users always jump around and some users would always stay.
In this case, because you're measuring in terms of noise, you would, right? Everybody's measuring X in noise. Right? The noise is different, but probably one for everybody. So some guys go, some guys don't go based on the measurement. So if anybody has a measurement greater than Y star, they go. If they have a measurement less than Y star, they stay. Okay? And everybody has. So the group of guys who go, which is alpha, is the really the probability of Y greater than Y star because it's normalized. Alpha is the percentage of people which go. Yes?
Yeah. The assumption that people are less synchronized.
How do you mean by synchronized?
If everyone was to decide to move at the same time based on measurements taken at the same time slot, then they could.
But what is the probability of all the measurements are the same? Because they're measured in IID noise, right? So the measurement vector is y is x plus w. W is some noise. The probability that two people have the same measurement is very low. I mean, if you assume it's Gaussian noise. Yeah, at this stage it's a one-shot gain, which is a Bayesian Nash, right? So you're taking a measurement, and then you're deciding whether you go or not to the nightclub to optimize your conditional expectation. Yeah, this is the definition of the Nash. This is the utility function you optimize E of HU, X, alpha. Okay? Now, let's just work a few more details to figure out what we can say about this Nash equilibrium. So this is a conditional expectation. Remember, H was the quality of music times the scale factor plus F, which was the function which is up and down, the quasi-concave function. Alpha x is the conditional probability of going to the nightclub given your measurement X. Okay, this you can show pretty straightforward by Bayes' rule. So your conditional expectation of your utility given Y is simply this guy here. Okay, and your aim for this to be a threshold Nash is to show that this function as a function of Y intersects the zero axis just once. It has a single crossing. Okay, if it intersects it multiple times, then your policy is not very nice because then it's not going to be threshold. Okay, so back to the figure. If this policy intersects just once here, then you know that to the left of that you don't go, to the right of that you go. Okay. Whoops, going down here. So the aim is what is a sufficient condition for a single crossing. In general, that's pretty hard to guess. Okay. A simpler condition is a sufficient condition for this conditional expectation to be monotone in Y. Because they're monotone, then you will cross at least once. Okay. This problem is fairly simple to answer from an abstract point of view. Given a conditional expectation with respect to some value Y, under what conditions is that monotone in its argument Y? And you can use some fairly basic ideas in stochastic ordering to answer that. So a fairly straightforward and obvious result is that if the conditional a posteriori density X given Y1 dominates X given Y2 in a likelihood ratio sense, that simply means that the ratio of the two densities is increasing in Y. Okay. Then, for any increasing function h of x comma alpha x, the conditional expectation of one dominates the conditional expectation of another. This is pretty obvious. This is a fairly straightforward result. The reason being that likelihood dominance is a stronger condition than first order stochastic dominance, and first order stochastic dominance for an increasing function automatically implies this. Okay, so we're putting a stronger condition than first order stochastic dominance. Dominance in likelihood ratio is stronger. Okay, the reason why we do need dominance in likelihood ratio is because we have to survive a conditional expectation, and first order stochastic dominance does not survive a conditional expectation, so you need to use really likelihood ratios. It's well known that if a likelihood ratio ordering, if one random variable dominates another random variable, then a conditional expectation of the random variable also dominates a conditional expectation of other random variable. So likelihood ratio ordering preserves that sort of ordering. That's kind of well known. So the question then boils down to, under what condition does one a posteriori distribution stochastically dominate another a posteriori distribution? Because if this guy dominates that guy, then clearly this is greater than that for y1 greater than y2, meaning that the function is monotone in y. Okay, so the question boils down to, how do you show that a posteriori distribution stochastically dominates another a posteriori distribution? For this, the result is actually well known, and Witt, for example, has a very nice result that you can relate the a posteriori distribution to the likelihood. Okay, so essentially, if two guys have the same prior, okay, then if one likelihood stochastically dominates the other likelihood, then it's if and only if condition for the a posteriori to dominate the other a posteriori. Okay, so all we need to have is, since y given x is simply a distribution of the noise, we can simply come up with a condition of the distribution of the noise together with the monotonicity of h of x comma alpha x to give conditions for which this guy is monotone in Y. Okay, so just conditions of the noise and conditions of h of x comma alpha x sufficed to give conditions for this to be monotone in Y, which sufficed to give you conditions on the figure which I had on the previous page, which was that figure there, for this to be monotone. Okay. Remember that you don't need monotonicity. You actually only need a single crossing, but coming up with single crossing conditions are very difficult in general. Yeah.
So can you give a force in the collector? Can you say something about the alpha? So the alpha seems to be because noise is the force.
Alpha, exactly. So the conditional expectation of alpha given X is given simply by the probability that every user receives an observation greater than Y star, the threshold, right? Because those are the guys who go to the nightclub. So it's the integral for Y star to infinity of the conditional density of Y given X. This is alpha of X. Okay.
Everybody wants
yeah.
Strategy.
Yes.
If alpha seems, probably converts to the, like expected value or something.
Oh, but the law of large numbers, it would be the probability that y is greater than y star given x, right? since everybody has an independent measurement of their observation, the number of guys who go to the nightclub are the number of guys who have an observation greater than Y star. Correct? By the law of large numbers, that's simply P of Y given greater than Y star given X. This stuff is all mine. This is kind of well known from Global Gains. This is not really a big deal. Okay?
What if there are two nightclubs where you're above the threshold and
both of them? I don't want to talk about one nightclub. I'll come to the multiple nightclub case later. That's you use as multivariate ordering, okay? So the moment we just have one nightclub, you can either choose to stay at home or go. So it could be in a sensor activation. I either have my sensor off or I decide to turn on. Okay. The easy generalization of this is where you have multiple classes of sensors but still going to one nightclub. So multiple classes of patrons. Somebody listens to the quality of music and says, aha, the guitarist is good, so I'm going to go. Somebody else listens and says, the pianist is good, and I'm going to go. But it's still one nightclub. To go to multiple nightclubs is harder. It involves multivariate stochastic dominance, which is not so clean. Okay, so that is the result. And here's a simplified example of the final solution. So suppose everybody measures the quality of music X, where X is some prior, pi zero, in noise, where noise is, say, in this case, I'm going to assume to be Gaussian. Okay, you can take it for lots of different types of distributions and give conditions, of course. And if I don't go to the nightclub, I get a reward of zero. If I do go to the nightclub, I get a reward of Ci of X plus F of alpha, where alpha is the percentage of people who went. Okay. Assume pi zero, the prior is Gaussian, and W is also Gaussian, okay, and WI is independent with respect to I, so everybody, noise is independent of everybody else, okay, that's an essential assumption which is very hard to dispense with, okay. Then you can show that the equilibrium is threshold if the derivative of F with respect to alpha, so utility function with respect to alpha, does not drop off too quickly. Now let's just go back to the idea here. So F of alpha, I told you, is something which goes up and then down, right, typically. If it drops down really fast with large alpha, that means there's a lot of congestion. So this is a condition on the amount of congestion you can allow for the threshold policy to hold. If this condition is viable, well, this is a sufficient condition, okay? So if df by d alpha is larger than this, then you can show the threshold policy, okay? Just by using the conditions I gave you before. The first, the monotone likelihood ratio condition holds, and df by d alpha greater than this. It's fairly easy to verify this condition. What is much more kind of non-trivial to show, which is also probably very interesting, is that if sigma gets sufficiently small, okay, so the noise variance gets sufficiently small, or I haven't put the condition here, but if F1 minus F0 becomes very negative, so that means F1 really drops away very fast. Okay, remember alpha is between 0 and 1, the normalized number of people who go, then the Nash equilibrium is no longer a threshold. In fact, the Nash equilibrium becomes really weird then. It becomes that the paper by Karp and so on characterizes it for the uniform case. It becomes something which is highly irregular. For certain observations, you go and then you don't go and then you go and you don't go. And those islands where you go and don't go become more and more irregular in the function. It becomes really very weird. Okay, so it's kind of interesting if you think of this problem. So as a sector, if you're measuring something, okay, the more measurements you take, your noise variance averages, it goes as 1 over n as you take n measurements. You're chugging away and your Nash equilibrium is threshold, that is every time it's greater than something, you activate, you take a measurement, and you keep taking your average. Suddenly, this condition will hold. And your threshold, your Nash equilibrium is no longer a threshold. So there's this drastic transition in the beginning. Until it hits it, your policy is monotone Y in the sense that as the larger your observation, there is a value beyond which you take measurements, less than which you don't. As soon as your average or your noise variance, which is average, becomes smaller, then something weird happens, okay, which is very interesting. The paper by Karp completely characterizes it for the case of uniform noise. This is a condition for the Gaussian noise. It's slightly different. So the point is that the phase transition takes place as the certainty of the system increases. The intuitive idea behind this is quite clear, because if you consider the nightclub problem, if certain patrons had exact measurement of the quality of music, and the quality of music was very high, then they would know that everybody else was going to go to the nightclub as well, because the quality of music is high. Okay, so they may not go, and the thing becomes really weird. So there's this anticipative feature of the problem which makes it pretty weird when the noise variance gets very small. Or when F dies out fast, when the congestion is large. Okay, now let's go on to the multivariate case, which is substantially harder, and I'm just going to make a few comments here. So suppose you now have three possibilities, okay? Possibility zero is that you stay at home, possibly one, you go to nightclub one, possibly two, you go to nightclub two. Or this could be viewed as you have three spectral gaps, okay? You either remain in your current spectral gap, or you go to another one or a third one, okay? Or it could be that you have three possible targets you're measuring at different centers. Under what conditions does your Nash equilibrium have a structure like this, that if Y1 is greater than some value Y1 star, then you go to nightclub 1, and there's a switching curve. If Y2 is greater than G of Y1, then you go to nightclub 2, otherwise you stay at home. When do you have this sort of switching curve behavior? Well, you can come up with some nice sufficient conditions for that. Okay, I'm just going to very quickly list the conditions here. Unfortunately, there's only one of three possibilities. Beyond this, it's very hard to generalize a switching curve. On the right-hand side, I have something which generalizes to actually multiple possible nightclubs, but the conditions there are much stronger. Okay, so let's start with the left-hand side. So in this case, you can see the policy you seek to get from your Nash equilibrium is something which, if Y is greater than Y1 star, this line here, it's going down, because you go to right, you're going from 2 to 1. Okay? So your optimal policy, the argmax, the utility, because remember the argmax gives you the action you take, you want the argmax of the function to go downhill from 2 to 1. And as you increase in Y2, you want to go uphill from 1 to 2. Okay? So what you want is really your policy, mu of Y1, Y2, to be decreasing in Y1 and increasing in Y2. Okay? Now, the standard results of this sort of stuff simply leads you to have, for the argmax, the policy, which is the argmax of this utility function, to be increasing in Y2 and decreasing in Y1, you just need something called supermodularity and submodularity. So a submodular function in U and Y1 is one where U star of Y1 is decreasing in Y1. Okay, this is well known. So you can come up with a condition of submodularity. Submodularity simply means that H of U given this Y1, Y2 minus H of U with a larger U that has decreasing differences. Okay, that's what submodularity is. And to be increasing in U, Y2, you simply need supermodularity, which is the negative of a submodular function. And that gives you the argmax increasing in Y2. Okay? So under these conditions, and you can show that you have a Nash equilibrium of this structure. Okay? The conditions which come out to show all this are not very intuitive. You can numerically verify them, but they're not very clean answers. They're not as clean as the univariate case. Okay? Notice that in this case, we managed to actually reduce it to single variate type things. You're simply looking at U, Y1, U, Y2. You don't have to consider Y1, Y2, which would be much harder. Now, you can think of another case which has monotone type Nash, where when Y1 and Y2 are jointly in some smaller region, you pick action 0, otherwise you pick action 1, otherwise you pick action 2. Okay? Now, to have this sort of structure is somewhat more difficult, because then you need your utility function to be increasing in some sort of partial ordering sense. What you need is x1 and x2 are jointly increasing, that h of x1, x2 is increasing. Okay? So in this case, what you need is your argmax of the policy to be monotone jointly in y1, y2. Okay? What does it mean for one vector to dominate another vector? Well, the ordering we use here is that as long as element-wise dominant is monotone. Okay? So if then your policy is monotone. Then for that, you can give sufficient conditions for your Nash equilibrium to be monotone, and it involves a multivariate ordering, which is a TP2 ordering. You might remember in the univariate case, I told you the monotone likelihood ratio ordering suffices. The multivariate generalization of the monotone likelihood ratio is a TP2 ordering, which simply means that if you take the matrix of observations given your measurement, the likelihood, that should have second order minors, which is strictly positive. That's the condition for that. And you need that H1 of X, alpha X minus H2 of X, alpha X is increasing in X. Okay? Again, these conditions can be checked numerically pretty easily, but coming up with simple intuitive values are not easy. So, but you can actually numerically come up with examples nicely which have this sort of characteristic. And then in three dimensions, you can have there will be hyperplanes, okay? So you have one hyperplane beyond which you don't go, further than which you go to nightclub 1, then nightclub 2, nightclub 3, and so on. Okay, so that is the first example of a type of methodology which can be used for decentralized control, this approach of global games, where everybody simply measures something and then they decide based on the measurement what to do, and they're simply saying in some cases the Nash equilibrium has a very nice structure. Okay. The second approach which I want to quickly talk about is how you can deal with less structure in the problem, fewer assumptions, and learn something called a correlated equilibrium for the same type of problem, for dynamic spectrum axis or in a sensor network. Okay. The main ideas in this are really to deal with a stochastic approximation algorithm. Okay. And they're interested in looking at the convergence of the stochastic approximation algorithm. What is really quite notable in this is that there's been a lot of work, of course, in convergence analysis of stochastic approximation algorithms pioneered by people like Harold Kushner and so on. Traditionally, stochastic approximations in their limit have a limiting process which is a differential equation, an ordinary differential equation. It's called the ODE approach, okay? What is quite surprising, which I guess that it's not a big deal now because there's been several papers recently, is that in this particular case, you end up with a differential inclusion rather than a differential equation. So you have a dx by dt belongs to a particular set. What is even more surprising, which is that in some cases, you don't even end up with a deterministic limit. You end up with a limit which is, for example, Markovian switched. Okay, so you end up with a Markovian switched differential inclusion. This is a result which came out in a paper I wrote with my colleague George Yid at SIAM in 2004 and also a more recent paper in math programming. So I'm going to briefly describe those results. So again, we come up to the problem where you have, say, L users which, again, can jump into several spectrum holes. In this case, actually, you can make it much more general that they can, for example, jump to multiple spectrum holes. So in the global games approach, you could only choose one nightclub, right? Now you can actually cut yourself in half and go to one nightclub, the other half go to another nightclub, which makes sense in spectrum allocation. You could jump to several spectrum holes in some tendency transmit. Okay. The utility, I'm not going to talk too much in detail, I can talk offline, but you know, the choice of utility is something which is a huge problem. I mean, it's a huge issue. There's so many ways of choosing good utility function. I don't want to get into that here. Suffice to say, it depends on the channel quality vector you measure. XL here denotes your action. In standard game theoretic notation, X of minus L denotes the action of all the other guys. Okay. We assume some sort of CSMA system where each user, if it grabs the channel, other people wait. Otherwise, if there's contention, you kind of wait for a uniform amount of time, uniformly distributed back off, and then you transmit. Okay. The main point I want to come up with is the actual algorithm. So here is something called a regret tracking algorithm, where if each user deploys this in a decentralized fashion, you can show that the global behavior of the system converges to a set of correlated equilibria. Okay. Why is this useful? Well, you can imagine in sensor networks that the idea of the design is that you give each sensor a very simple protocol or algorithm, and your aim might be that if each sensor runs this very simple algorithm, what can I say about the global behavior of the network? It's a perfectly legitimate question. The simple algorithm each sensor is going to run is called a regret matching or regret minimization algorithm, which simply says that at each time I take a particular action, maybe to sense or to jump to a particular spectral gap, and compute how much better off I would have been had I not taken that action and picked some other action. The way I compute that is because I've picked other actions in the past and I judge it based on my history. I keep a history of all my actions in the past. Okay, and that's basically what I'm doing here. This is simply an average of U of L is what I pick for a particular action. This is what I could have picked. So this is like a regret. This is simply like a moving average of the regret weighted by some step size epsilon n. Okay, so it's like a stochastic. So epsilon n is a small step size. This is simply a fancy way of writing just a moving average, discounted average by epsilon n. Okay. Epsilon n is a step size which I'm going to pick to be actually a fixed value because we're going to look at weak convergence. The choice of your action is picked actually according to a Markov chain. So each time you pick your action according to a probability distribution, which is a function of your regret which you computed this step. Okay. So you can think of a two-step procedure. I pick my action by flipping a coin according to a Markov chain, and then I update my regret, and that affects my transition probability the next instant I pick my action, and so on. Okay. This algorithm was proposed by Scolell in Econometrica in year 2000. Well, they did with a decreasing step size, and we made certain modifications there as well. Now, so each sensor can run this very simple adaptive filter, so to speak, and your aim is to see what can you say about the global behavior of the system. Okay. The diagnostic of the global behavior would be something which keeps a counter as to what were the different actions taken by everybody. Okay. So this is not something each sensor has to run. This is some diagnostic which maybe a centralized network operator might know. You don't have to run this, but this is going to be what we're going to talk about the convergence about. Okay. So this is literally a history of global actions of what everybody's taken. E of x is simply an indicator vector with one in the ith position. So E of x simply denotes which action each guy took. Epsilon n is the step size. So this is, again, a moving average. The question is, what can you say about the convergence of the Zn of these different actions? Well, you can show that this process, Z of n, this random process, converges. And I'm going to describe what I mean by converge in much more detail in the next page. Converges to a set of correlated equilibria. The set of correlated equilibria is a generalization of the Nash equilibrium. The Nash equilibrium, as many of you know, is simply a fixed, very nasty to characterize in general. Correlated equilibrium, which I guess Aumann was one of the leading people who came up with that, is simply runs under the assumption that users do not pick their actions independently, as in a Nash, but they pick it according to a joint distribution. Okay, as Aumann says in much of his work, it's much more realistic and natural than a Nash, because in a learning process, you always kind of figure out what other people are doing, so you really never act in isolation. So in reality, correlated equilibria are much more realistic in that sense. From a convergence point of view, also, it's much nicer because it's a convex polytope. You don't need any fixed point type stuff. All you have to show is that ZT, in some sense, converges to somewhere inside this convex polytope. So the proof of convergence is substantially simpler. Proving convergence to a Nash is really hard. I mean, proving existence of a Nash is not that hard. It's the fixed point theorem. But proving convergence to a Nash is usually extremely hard. You need to show it's attractive. There's a Lyapunov function which pulls it into that and so on. Whereas for correlated equilibrium, it turns out to be substantially easier. Okay, so the aim is to really show that if each guy runs the simple adaptive filter, then the overall behavior of the network, that is the action taken by everybody, actually converges to a correlated equilibrium. This simply means in terms that if anybody cheats from the behavior, they become like the Nash, except now they're acting in a way according to a joint distribution. The Nash equilibrium would pop out as a special case when this became a product distribution, so that means they're all acting independently. So I'm just very briefly going to talk about the convergence analysis of this. So the standard convergence analysis of this is to first take the discrete time process Z of n and, for convenience, interpolate it and form a continuous time process. This is the usual way people like Kushner and so on do it, which is very clean mathematically. It's just a formalization of that. So you construct this process which belongs to the phase D of Cadillac functions, continuous on the right and limits on the left. So this is an interpolated continuous time process, and the point then is that this interpolated continuous time process, as epsilon scales to zero, converges weakly to a differential inclusion which looks like this. And one can show by constructing a Lyapunov function, which I'm going to do here, that this differential inclusion pulls you to that set which I had on the previous page, which was basically there. Okay? So what you have is a family of trajectories given by this differential inclusion. Well, differential inclusion is just a generalization of differential equation, and a differential equation have an equal sign here. This is a class of trajectories. What we're saying is that this class of trajectories is pulled into this polytope. Okay. The proof of that is actually very nice. It's also called Blackwell approachability, and it's based on a Lyapunov function argument, which I can certainly discuss offline if anybody's interested. Okay, so that would be the main idea. Now, of course, from an engineering point of view, what happens often is that your system is not static, but your system is changing over time, which means that your set of equilibria are also changing over time. For example, a target could move out of position and suddenly change. The structure or the statistics of your spectral gaps could suddenly jump change. How can you track a set of correlated equilibria which is time-varying? How well does that algorithm, which I proposed in the previous page, track a moving set? See, that's a fair enough question to ask, because in reality, things do move. Things are not stationary. Well, I guess there are three ways you can look at it. If the correlated equilibrium set, say, moves according to some Markovian process, transition probability matrix I plus rho Q, where Q is a generator. So rho is some small number here, okay? The point then would be, how does rho match epsilon, where epsilon is the step size of the algorithm? Okay? So rho is the speed at which something is moving the system, and epsilon is the step size. There are three possibilities. Possibility one is that rho is substantially smaller than epsilon, in which case you're very happy. If the system moves much slower than my algorithm, then I'm done. Convergence is straightforward. And so that then the above result holds. Case two is very interesting. If rho is order epsilon, so for example, rho equals epsilon, okay, then things are substantially harder. In that case, you do not end up with a deterministic differential inclusion. What is kind of really surprising is when you apply stochastic averaging theory, you end up with a differential inclusion with a random term S of T here, the Markov chain, where S of T is a continuous time Markov chain with generator Q. Okay? So in this case, the so-called averaging theory actually gives you something which is a stochastic limit, not a deterministic limit. Okay? I'll talk about this very briefly on the next page. The third case, which is usually never considered, I guess, in adaptive filtering, is when the system moves much faster than your algorithm can track. In that case, you have no hope of tracking the system. All you can track is the average behavior. Okay, I'm not going to talk about that in much detail here. Okay, I want to talk more about this particular case here because it kind of warrants a bit of discussion in the sense that the limit is not deterministic, which is kind of pretty interesting. I mean, this sort of stuff has been looked at by Harold Kushner in great detail, and there's some very nice work in this, but I just want to talk just about the way you go about showing this sort of stuff. So how do you prove some of these results? I mean, just a flavor of that, because they're normally pretty technical, and I just sort of give a quick flavor of that. So it really goes in a number of steps, and step one would be, first of all, given a point Y which belongs to the set, you want to show that your algorithm, which is generating this process Zn bar, remember that was a diagnostic, that in some sense the mean square error of that is order epsilon. Okay, you can prove that by some fairly complicated arguments. So this is purely by looking at those difference equations of the algorithm, minus the error, you get some sort of error equation, and you try and show that that error equation gives you something which is order epsilon, where epsilon was the step size. The usual way to do this is called something called a perturbed Lyapunov function approach. Again, I can discuss it offline. There's no time to go in here. Okay. Step two is the really cool step, which has been, I guess, really solidified by several fantastic mathematicians like Struck and Varadin and Etier and Kurtz and so on. The step there is you solve something called the martingale problem. The basic idea is, I'm probably running out of time, I guess. The basic idea in a martingale problem is that you want to show that your continuous time process, the interpolated process, satisfies a particular structure which yields a martingale. Okay? The point is this, that if Z, S was the process which was interpolated, then if you can set up a generator L for the limit process Z, S, then if you can show that this guy minus some function of his generator is a martingale, then you can actually prove that this interpolated process converges to the same limit. So the idea is roughly this. There are, if you look at a stochastic differential equation, there are two ways of talking about the solution. One is in the ego sense, where you actually explicitly solve this and you come up with an answer. The other is more subtle approach, which is much nicer, is that you look at an operator approach. You look at the generator of that, and you try and look at perturbations of the generator and show those perturbations converge to the original generator. Okay. What it boils down to, although this looks pretty dirty, is that you have some test function F. This is your actual interpolated algorithm. It has epsilon. This is L, the actual generator of what you're looking for the final process. And you want to show roughly that this dirty guy gives you zero at the end of it. This difference now is decomposed into four differences because you can now perturb S holding this other guy constant and so on. You work out the bounds, and eventually if you can show that it's zero, then you can show that this algorithm converges to that particular operator L, which is the operator for this stochastic differential inclusion. Okay. So that would be roughly the proof. I mean, this is really not a proof, it's just a hand-waving argument, but the proof is much more intricate. The final point being that you end up with a switched stochastic differential inclusion in this case. The reason why I tell you that is really hard is, under what conditions does this guy converge to the set of correlated equilibria? And it's very hard to say anything. In the case where the system moved much slower than the target, than the algorithm, remember there was no S, it was deterministic, in which case you could come up with a simple Lyapunov function to prove convergence. Now you're completely screwed, you can't do that. It's a much harder problem. You can't really say anything. So it's an open issue as to what happens to this convergence of this differential equation. Where does it converge to? Another open issue is, usually in a stochastic approximation, you can first come up with a limit, which is like an ODE or a differential inclusion, And the second step is you can look at the error between the estimate and the true value scaled, and that satisfies the functional central limit theorem, okay, or diffusion process. The moment you have a differential inclusion, it's not known what's going to be like. A functional central limit theorem is not going to hold it. It's a pretty complicated problem, and we have no clue how to solve that for the rate at which the error goes to zero. Okay, I'm rapidly running out of time, I guess, so I'm just going to skip part three. I can talk to you if anybody's interested in that. So just a few concluding remarks. The major issue that which I didn't want to get into is how to choose a good utility function, because I'm sure the engineers will kind of shoot me down. That's always a hard problem, but presumably some of this, as long as it satisfies the conditions, you can say that's a good utility function. That's a bit of a cop-out, but anyway, that's one way of saying. Another way of thinking about good utility functions is to use the fortune mechanism design, where there are incentives for sensors to report correct values. A very simple example of that is the following. Suppose you had a cognitive radio system where several radios are designed so that they can transmit when the primary user is not transmitting, right? What if one radio were to simply bluff and say that the primary user is transmitting, so that other radios sort of maybe think that it's a highly believable radio and they back off for that reason, when actually the primary user was not transmitting, so this radio could exploit it and jump in? How do you design incentives or utility functions to prevent that sort of lying behavior? That's very important, and as many of you know, Meyerson won last year's Nobel Prize in Economics for coming up with very clever methods and mechanism design. So these are very important problems then. But anyway, those are proper ways of choosing utility functions, but that's sort of beyond here. Second question, how realistic are the assumptions? We needed stuff like particular terms of stochastic dominance and monotone functions and so on. In some ways, I guess since they're class valued, they might be reasonable assumptions, but of course they should be questioned. How good are equilibria? Both for Nash and correlated equilibrium, you know, showing that they're Pareto optimal is usually very, very hard. What you can do is put some sort of pricing variable at an outer level and optimize it so you could guide your equilibria to nicer places, but in some ways, that's not very nice. It would be much nicer to be able to say something.
But if you said Nash with Pareto, then, you know, there's something wrong. I mean, you're not having a very efficient game, right? I mean, isn't it Nash? I mean, Pareto will always dominate Nash.
Not always, no. Nash can be Pareto optimal in many cases. In many useful cases.
It's an inessential game.
Yeah, but no, how good is your Nash otherwise? Because you could end up with a Nash which is really pathetic behavior, right? So the point is, if there are multiple Nashes, can you at least guide perhaps to a better Nash? And those are highly, so although an analysis that you gave here is nice, it's highly unsatisfactory in that sense. It simply says locally if one guy departs, it's worse off. But so what? I mean, if two guys depart, you might be able to do better, right? So if you collaborate with them. I didn't talk about the PMDP part, so I'm going to skip that. There's several open issues which do come about, and I just thought I'd mention them. One of them was the analysis of switch differential inclusions, which I said is really hard. Another thing which I didn't speak about here, but which actually is a very interesting problem in its own right, is operating stochastic control myopic policies are very useful, and sometimes proving that a policy is myopic boils down to showing some form of stochastic dominance of the operators of the system which evolve. And one simple case of that, which again is not easy to show, is suppose you have a transition matrix A for a simple Markov chain. Under what conditions can you factorize that transition matrix into the product of two other transition matrices, B and C? So in what case is a stochastic matrix the product of two other stochastic matrices? So given A, can you say there are two other matrices, B and C, which are stochastic, such as B times C is A? It's a highly non-trivial problem, but for those cases, you can actually show certain forms of myopic policies are optimal. Okay, that's all I wanted to say. Wow. At the end of the talk, this came alive.